This episode of Lights Out is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Light out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
And if you're listening to this, I am home with my new baby boy, enjoying some much needed time off with my family. And so you're listening to a pre-record. And nevertheless, same quality as you're used to. Danny and I are here to cover one of the most infamous unsolved mass shootings in U.S. history, but definitely one of the most infamous cases in New Mexico history, the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre. It's always insane to me when there's a mass casualty crime that remains unsolved after so many years. I mean, it's just hard to wrap your head around. So today we're going to take a look at what happened. Four people were left dead at the end of it. Two shooters are still unknown, uncaught. Try to figure out what happened here, because this case really just throws me through a loop. I have no idea how they did not get this solved. So let's go ahead and jump into it and take a look at what happened.
Hey guys, producer Daniel here. Just letting you know the Lights Out Spring Merch Collection is officially live. You can head over to milehighermerch.com right now to check out all the new designs on some warm weather pieces, plus some of the classic favorites like the tarot card shirt. Not only do we think you'll love the new collection, but you'll be able to give back too, since 100% of the merch proceeds are donated to the Higher Hope Foundation for grant funding victims of violent crime. Head over to milehighermerch.com now to shop those.
Let's begin by talking a little bit about Las Cruces, New Mexico. It was founded in 1849 despite multiple major booms in its economy, and the area always remained a major family town with the vast majority of houses being small, single-family homes. And along with this peaceful family atmosphere was an expected low crime rate. In 1980, the population had reached just over 44,000, and the yearly number of murders and manslaughters was zero. So a relatively safe place to live, and the total number of violent crimes was around 200. There were a few murders by 1985, but the overall violent crime rate had only risen to 250, with the population just being over 49,000 people. Las Cruces had become a safe place to raise your family and build a life. That's why the events that took place on February 10th, 1990 seemed too horrific to be true. That morning, 34-year-old Stephanie Senek arrived to complete her opening duties at the popular, family-owned and operated Las Cruces Bowling Alley. That day, she had brought along her 12-year-old daughter, Melissa Rapace, and Melissa's best friend, 13-year-old Amy Hauser. The two young girls are going to be in charge of the bowling alley's childcare room for that day. Another employee, the bowling alley's cook, Ida Holguin, was also starting her shift in the bowling alley's kitchen, where she was just cleaning and prepping food for the arrival of patrons when the bowling alley opened at 9 a.m. As she began working, two strange men entered the building through an unlocked door around 8:20 a.m. At first, I'd assume they were part of a maid service that sometimes came to clean the building. The men separated upon entering the bowling alley, with one heading toward the front of the establishment and one lingering near Ida. The man lingering in the kitchen suddenly pulled out a .22 caliber pistol and aimed it at her. The man told her to come with him and that this was a holdup. And then he hit her on the head several times with the gun before forcing Ida to walk to the front of the bowling alley and into Stephanie Senek's office. Upon entry, Ida quickly learned what the other mysterious man had been doing, intercepting Stephanie and the girls as they entered the building and forcing them into Stephanie's office, where they were being held at gunpoint. The gunmen ordered the women and children to lie on the floor face down while they ransacked the bowling alley's office and safe, clearly looking for something. One of the gunmen ordered Stephanie to open the office's safe, and to this day, it's unclear exactly what they took from the office other than about $4,000 to $5,000 that the bowling alley's owner claimed was missing from the safe. What was odd is that they didn't take all the money that was inside of that safe. The men also began frantically going through the desk drawers and other compartments, seemingly looking for something besides just money. But we have no idea what it is that they were looking for. As the men were terrorizing the four victims in the office, the pin mechanic, Steve Tehran, arrived for a shift at the bowling alley. Steve had recently put his 2-week notice in at the bowling alley and he was expecting a third child with his wife, who was due any day. And though the man was looking forward to spending time with his family and his newborn, he didn't want to leave his coworkers at the bowling alley without any help. So even though he didn't have childcare for his two older children, Steve packed the girls up and headed into work. He expected to leave the two young girls, 6-year-old Paula and 2-year-old Valerie, in the childcare center with Melissa and her friend Amy. However, when he entered the bowling alley, he found it eerily silent and immediately knew that something was wrong. Steve wandered around the building for a few minutes trying to find his coworkers. He checked the kitchen and the childcare center, but there was no one to be found. Finally, Steve and the girls went to Stephanie Senek's office, where they walked into the most terrifying and violent scene of women and girls lying on the floor with guns pointed at their heads. The gunman quickly forced Steve to lie on the floor with his small children. The victims likely thought they'd be left behind after the men were done robbing the bowling alley. But the truth was much more sinister. After they finished ransacking the office, the men chose to take the most evil route and shot all 7 victims multiple times in the body and head, making sure no witnesses were left behind, despite how young some of the victims were. And it would later be discovered that all the shots were at point-blank range, so all the victims were shot execution style. Even the youngest victims were shot multiple times. As if the shooting wasn't heinous enough, around 8:30 a.m., the gunman took the time to set fire to the office by igniting a pile of papers before they left out the front door. At 8:33 a.m., the first call to 911 happened. A person passing by the bowling alley had seen the smoke coming from the roof. Dispatchers began to organize the dispersal of firefighters when a second call, only moments after the first, came in. The caller was 12-year-old Melissa Repass, the young victim who had been shot 5 times. The critically wounded girl had regained consciousness shortly after the men fled, was able to find a phone and make that 911 call. Now let's go ahead and play a clip of Melissa's 911 call. Warning, it is extremely difficult to listen to.
Okay, and there were shots fired?
Yes.
All of us were hurt.
Huh?
All of us were hurt. I think I'm the only one conscious. All of you were hurt? Okay, we'll get an ambulance rolling.
Please.
Okay, what's your name?
Melissa Repass. Please hurry.
Okay, Melissa, we've got them dispatched. Did you see who did it?
No, sir. They told us all to get down. They shot me 5 times.
Okay, we'll get them rolling, Melissa. Just hang on. Take a deep breath. We've got patrol units in route. How many people are hurt?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
7 people are hurt?
Yes, I think.
7 subjects hurt. Okay. Okay, Melissa.
It hurts.
It hurts. Okay. Melissa, I've got an ambulance and I've got the police officers en route. They'll be with you just shortly.
Okay.
Okay. You didn't see what any of the
Mom,
men were
they
wearing?
All of our money.
You didn't see what any kind of the men were wearing or anything?
No.
Nothing, huh? They just walked in?
Uh-huh.
Do you know if they were black men, white men?
One black man. They're both black.
2 black men?
Yeah.
Okay. No, they've left. 2 black male.
Please hurry.
Okay, okay. It's okay, Melissa.
There's a fire, too.
There's a fire?
Right on the desk. They're going to burn us up.
Are the men still there?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. They put us in the office.
They put you in the office?
Yes, I need a fire engine, too. Please help me.
And two. Okay, Melissa. She said they locked them in the office. She doesn't know if they're still there or not.
The door's open. There's a fire.
It's on Amador, yeah.
Please
help. Can you smell smoke, Melissa?
Yes, I can see it.
Okay.
Can I get the fire extinguisher?
Fire department, too?
Yes.
She says she smells smoke. They may have lit the building on fire.
No, it is on fire.
It is on fire.
It is.
Okay, Melissa.
Can I go
get by utility one?
Oh, ow.
Okay.
Melissa told the dispatcher that she'd been shot in the head and knew she was going to die. Still, Melissa continued to answer the dispatcher's questions in an act that would be credited for saving other lives. She was even able to tell the dispatcher directions to get into the office from the front entrance of the building, which allowed first responders to quickly find all the victims and render aid. First responders quickly rushed into the smoke-filled building guided by Melissa's directions, and they located the victims and pulled them all out of the building. It soon became clear that they'd been shot by someone who wanted to be certain that they would not survive. Steve Tehran, Amy Hauser, and 6-year-old Paula were pronounced dead at the scene. Ida Holguin, Stephanie Senek, Melissa Repass, and Valerie Tehran were rushed to the hospital. Tragically, 2-year-old Valerie would pass away upon arriving at the hospital. Ida, Stephanie, and Melissa, however, made miraculous recoveries. Though reports on injuries are not publicly available, Melissa suffered 5 gunshot wounds, at least one of which was to the head, as she described in her 911 call. Police later revealed that at least 25 rounds had been fired, which for the number of victims was a lot of bullets. And let's remember that 4 of the victims were children. And as devastating as the tragedy was, many thought about another terrifying fact. At 9 a.m. that day, the Junior Bowling League for Kids was scheduled to play. Around 40 children were expected that day, and had the gunmen arrived just a half hour later, the death toll would have likely been much, much higher. But in the end, 5 people were murdered and 2 were injured. Despite the media coverage over the past 35 years, there is surprisingly very little information available talking about the victims' lives before this very tragic day. Though the families of the victims and the survivors are forced to deal with the memories of that day, it seems many in the community at large have forgotten the events or have tried to just straight up forget them. Ida Holguin is one of the lone survivors. She was 33 at the time of the shooting, and as you might expect, left her position as a cook immediately after this day. She does not speak about the events from that day, repeatedly turning down offers to appear in memorial events as well as videos. The only thing we really know is that she has expressed that the pain of that day still haunts her, and she suffers from severe anxiety and panic attacks even 30 years later. Ida's husband, Raymond, said it took 6 months for Ida to be released from the hospital. Ida suffered from panic and anxiety attacks, headaches, and PTSD. Her brain injuries made it difficult for her to do everyday things, and she had to relearn everything. Each year, on the anniversary of the event, Ida travels to Albuquerque, which is 3 hours away from Las Cruces, to get distance between her and the place where her life was changed forever. However, Ida's life has seen some positivity as she became a grandmother and told Raymond that her grandkids finally showed her why God allowed her to live. Steve Tehran, the mechanic who lost his life and both of his daughters during the massacre, was 36 years old and preparing to begin a new chapter in his life as a father to 3 children. Steve's brother Anthony was fresh out of high school when his brother was killed, and he often looks back at photos of Steve in the military where he learned his mechanic skills and remembers what his brother always tried to teach him, to always do the right thing. And that's part of the inspiration behind Anthony still showing up to speak about his brother and nieces every year on the anniversary of their murder, even 35 years later. Steve's widow, Audra, was also permanently scarred that day by the loss of the love of her life and her 2 beautiful children. Audra remembers him as a hardworking man who always put his family first. Those who knew Steve said that he was loyal to a fault, which is why he even went to work on that February morning, despite not being able to find a babysitter for his daughters Paula and Valerie. Audra described Paula Holguin, the boisterous 6-year-old, as a girly girl with a bubbly personality, whose favorite color was fuchsia. Paula also was a wonderful big sister to 2-year-old Valerie, the youngest victim. Valerie may have been small, but she was already coming into her personality. Audra described her as a total opposite of her doting big sister and reserved like her father. She loved to wear anything blue and preferred jeans and a t-shirt to dresses. And despite their differences, the girls had a beautiful bond and should have had the opportunity to grow up together. But as Audra put it, someone decided to play God and take their lives. Amy Hauser was Melissa's best friend, and she was a loving girl with a naturally nurturing personality. She left behind a little brother, Mark Woods, who was 4 when Amy was killed. On the 25th anniversary of Amy's death, Mark spoke to KFOX 14 about his sister, and he told reporters that his earliest memories are fond ones of spending time with his sister and sitting on her lap as she played Nintendo. Melissa is the daughter of the bowling alley manager, Stephanie. She was a typical preteen of the 90s and loved spending time with her friends and finding ways to be a little bit independent. That's why she and her best friend Amy had gone to the bowling alley that day, to make some money by working in the nursery. Melissa was mature for her age and kept a level head in the face of chaos, which is a trait that saved her on that fateful day. Melissa suffered from PTSD from the incident, and though Melissa doesn't like to participate in memorial events, it is known that she went on to get married in 2002 and now has 2 children of her own. Melissa's mother, Stephanie, was also a victim that day and suffered from PTSD and lasting injuries from the shooting. Stephanie wasn't just the manager at the bowling alley. She was the daughter of the owner, Ronald Senek. She was 34 at the time of the shooting, a young mother hoping to have a good day of running the family business alongside her preteen daughter. However, like everyone else in the bowling alley that February morning, Stephanie's life changed for the worse, and she'd be left with wounds that simply could not heal. Despite surviving the shooting, she would lose her life in 1999 in what investigators say was a direct result of the injuries she suffered that day. This made her the 5th and final murder victim. This episode of Lights Out is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, potential savings will vary. Not available in all states. So circling back to the events that were unfolding in the bowling alley that day, less than an hour after the mass murder, police began roping off the bowling alley and the surrounding area. Still, they had to wait for a team from the State Department of Public Safety's crime lab to fly into Las Cruces from Santa Fe. The local police force wasn't equipped to handle such an extreme crime scene. And unfortunately, when the crime lab personnel arrived, it was clear the crime scene had been greatly contaminated by firefighters and emergency personnel, who understandably were prioritizing saving victims and putting out the fire over preserving the evidence of the crime scene. Firefighters had used a water hose to douse the flames, which most likely destroyed and contaminated evidence. Las Cruces police called in help from the New Mexico State Police, and unfortunately, investigators could not find enough evidence at the crime scene to put together a DNA profile for either gunman. They were able to recover fingerprints and shoe prints, but this didn't narrow it down much, since the bowling alley had many people come in and out of it on any given day. The officers soon began canvassing around the bowling alley and rounding up witnesses, hoping that someone had caught a glimpse of the gunman. One man, 22-year-old Albert Garcia, was across the street and heard at least a portion of the shooting. He told police that he heard 6 or 7 shots that sounded like caps. He didn't think much of it until police and firefighters rushed to the bowling alley's parking lot. Another witness was none other than Stephanie Senek's brother, Steve. And Steve told officers he had worked the closing shift at the bowling alley the night before. Early on the morning of the 10th, before Stephanie and the girls arrived, Steve had entered the building to retrieve a backpack he had forgotten from the prior evening. And after hearing about the crime, Steve told police that he had seen 2 men approach the bowling alley that morning as he was leaving. He watched as one man, who was noticeably older, hand a small case to another man. He then squatted down and made eye contact with Steve. His description of the men would later be used to create composite sketches of 2 Hispanic men who were thought to be the perpetrators, and these sketches were immediately released to the public. Later that day, police would take Steve Senek to one of the 10 highway roadblocks they set up around town to potentially identify the suspects from some of the men that they had stopped at those roadblocks. Once the roadblocks were up, law enforcement attempted to screen all drivers coming in and out of the Las Cruces area. At the time of the shooting, some eyewitnesses had seen two men driving a van or utility vehicle, possibly the colors tan or green. Steve was unable to definitively say that the men were the same as the ones he had seen earlier that morning, and the police had no choice but to let the suspicious strangers go. The Las Cruces Police Department spared no expense in trying to solve the crime and included the help of multiple agencies, including the New Mexico State Police, U.S. Army, and the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. But the assailants were never found. From the beginning, it became very clear that the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre would leave investigators very reliant on tips from the public in order to find the two shooters. Dozens and dozens of people called in tips with information, but none of the tips ever panned out. As decades passed, the families had been left without answers, and over the years there have been multiple attempts to revive the case, an effort that is kept alive in part by the continued efforts of Steve Terron's younger brother Anthony. Anthony continues to speak out on the case on the anniversary each year. On one anniversary, he told reporters for the Las Cruces Bulletin, "We have pictures on the walls. Every day I see them and it doesn't go away. Every conversation always comes around to something my brother did or said." Amy Hauser, who is a 13-year-old victim, also lives on in the memory of her loved ones. Her brother Mark Wood told reporters, "No one's come to justice for this. We haven't had any peace at all." The sentiment was shared by Steve Terron's widow, who gave birth to their youngest child only days after his death. She told reporters in 2022, "You wait and wait and wait. We've gotten to the point where we just don't get any answers." The victims' families aren't the only ones to never forget the crime. In 2011, a full-length film, A Nightmare in Las Cruces, was released. The film was directed by Charlie Min, and he told details of the crime, of course, and caught up with the victims' families after 20 years. The family and director hoped that the film would lead to a break in the case. Charlie Min told reporters that it's his belief that someone out there knows something, and that it's about time that that person stepped forward. But despite Min's plea, no viable tips were received as a result of his film. Law enforcement was able to speak to the survivors after they recovered from their injuries at various times, and through their accounts, investigators pieced together descriptions of the gunmen. The descriptions of the gunmen vary, but it's generally believed both perpetrators were Hispanic with dark skin. The older man was estimated to be anywhere from 50 to 70 in age. He had salt and pepper hair and a dark complexion. He stood about 5'7" and weighed 140 pounds, and he had a slight Spanish accent, but he was also fluent in English. The younger man was possibly in his 30s, possibly up to his 60s. He had wavy hair and light eyes, and he stood about 5'10" and weighed approximately 170 pounds. And he didn't have any noticeable accent. These new descriptions of the suspects were released to the public, and after this, more than 100 tips came in. Some tips mentioned two men running across Amador Avenue. Others mentioned a gang that operated a few blocks away from the bowling alley. Several tips claimed that they had seen the two men in the bowling alley on the night before the shooting, and these witnesses claimed that one gunman even hit on Stephanie that night. But she turned him down, so some claim that's the motive for the murders. These various tips ultimately led the investigation nowhere, though. The current detectives on the case don't seem to have given up hope, though. Detective Amador Martinez told CNN that even after all the years the case has been cold, they still receive tips. Though the tips have yet to change the course of the case, the fact that people are still thinking of the victims and trying to help is a testament to those who have worked so hard to keep the memories of those murdered alive. Despite the investigators' lack of advancement in this case, locals and followers around the world have openly discussed a few theories of their own. The most popular theory, the bowling alley's owner had ties to the cartel. So if you remember back, the bowling alley was owned by a man named Ronald Senak, the father of Stephanie and the grandfather of Melissa Repass. And from early in the investigation, onlookers believed the killings were not the result of a robbery, but were actually a violent message left for Ronald. But why? Because despite getting away with approximately $5,000, the assailants allegedly left behind a large undisclosed amount of money in the office safe. This theory made it difficult for investigators to determine if this truly was a robbery gone wrong or something much darker. This episode of Lights Out is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states. Investigators were intrigued by another specific rumor that the bowling alley had ties to organized crime. The rumor, though varying in details depending on who you asked, always came down to about the same thing. The owner, Ronald Senak. And possibly he had crossed paths with the wrong kind of people, which is why the gunman initially cornered his daughter and granddaughter. And as the rumor goes, Amy, Ida, Steve, and his young daughters were all collateral damage, and the only intended victims were Stephanie and Melissa. Ronald's brother Steve claimed that Ron had previously lived inside the bowling alley and was met by multiple strangers in the months before the shooting. Steven claimed that Ronald was $1.5 million in debt, and he was in so much debt that he had to reopen the bowling alley only a week after the shooting, which police and everybody else in the community found very suspicious. When police began questioning Ronald in the original investigation, he became uncooperative. Ronald claimed that the bowling alley had been robbed multiple times since the opening in 1984, and that money was the sole motive. He also claimed that he had gone to the police station every day for updates. Investigators claimed that this was untrue, and they had to track him down whenever they wanted to speak with him. Either way, investigators never uncovered any proof that Ron was connected to the shooting. Investigators told reporters, "We have investigated all of those angles at the time. Thousands and thousands of man hours have gone into trying to prove those theories, but we weren't able to prove anything. We put Ronald Senak under a microscope and we couldn't find anything. And to date, all we know for sure, it was a robbery homicide." After looking into Ronald Senak, investigators began to look at another potential connection to the crime, the man's youngest son, RJ. RJ Senak tended the bar at the bowling alley, and several tips claimed that RJ was involved in a substantial amount of drug activity. The theory was that RJ was potentially buying or selling cocaine at work. Then the gunman found out about this and tried to intercept the drugs. Police looked into the claims and discovered that RJ did in fact have an active cocaine addiction, but they said there was nothing there that could truly link him to the shooting. RJ's name was cleared at the time, and a few years later, in 1997, he passed away from a drug overdose at the age of 36. One of the most promising tips that police received early in the investigation came from a woman named Irma Tejerina. Irma called the police to let them know she believed the men who committed the crime had been temporarily staying in her home after meeting them at a nearby bar. They hid in her home when they heard the helicopters overhead looking for them. Although when police interviewed the woman, she appeared very high. She claimed the men killed the people at the bowling alley thinking there was a large stash of drugs inside. She also had no proof, but offered to take a polygraph test to prove that she was in fact telling the truth. Which, obviously, back in the 90s, polygraph tests were used all the time. And, you know, they're even still used today. So they had Irma take the polygraph, where she told police details about the men and the fact that they had been staying with her, saying she believed they committed the crime, and she ended up passing the polygraph test. However, Irma later recanted her statements, and many locals believe Irma was threatened or otherwise made to fear for her life if she didn't recant those statements. In a bizarre admission, she said that she lied about her story so that she would look good in front of the people in her community, hoping to get free drugs out of it. Police believe that Irma's frequent drug use made her an unreliable informant, and they ended up moving on from her tip. Similar to RJ Senak, Irma passed away in 2001 from an accidental drug overdose at the age of 43. Some of those living in Las Cruces at the time believe that there was a flood of gang violence going on and that perhaps the gang violence was connected to the murders at the bowling alley. And they also thought it may have been connected to another crime, the murder of Salvador Lozano. The incident took place on January 14, 1990, less than a month before the bowling alley massacre. Salvador worked at a local gas station and had gone there around 8 a.m. to open the store, which is the same time that Stephanie Senak opened the bowling alley. Later, two customers entered the unlocked store and found the lifeless body of 32-year-old Salvador. He had been shot execution style in the head. As far as we know, there aren't any known connections between Salvador and any gangs. Locals have also pointed out the similarity in how he was killed and the fact that the case seemed to quickly go cold despite local authorities claiming to be vigilantly searching for suspects. But in the 35 years since the Las Cruces bowling alley murders, the atmosphere of the town has changed, and the families and the survivors have been through a never-ending cycle of painful memories and investigations that have led nowhere. As we mentioned earlier, despite her miraculous survival in 1990, Stephanie Senek died in 1999 as a direct result of the injuries she suffered that day. Ida Holguin and Melissa Repass are both still alive, but do not speak about that day. Meanwhile, locals are left to wonder if the case will ever be solved, and many believe that the lack of remembrance by the local government is a sign that they never truly intended to solve the case. In 2015, Charlie Mint told local reporters that the local government's lack of care was leading to community apathy, a death sentence for any potential advancements in the case. He pointed out that local mayor at the time, Ken Miyagashima, was completely apathetic to the case. There was no memorial for the victims, no remembrance placed in the local news each year, and the mayor never even seemed to want to speak publicly on the case. Charlie also pointed out that the mayor couldn't even be bothered to attend the screening to his movie, which was an event put in place to try and find new leads on the long-standing mystery. Charlie Min told the Las Cruces Bulletin, "Miyagashima's apathy is disgusting," and pointed out that the lack of a public memorial was indicative of the local community's refusal to step up and deal with the scars left behind by this horrible tragedy. This episode of Lights Out is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, potential savings will vary. Not available in all states. In the years following the crime, memorials were placed and vigils were held in honor of the victims. Local churches held services to gain donations for wounded survivors and to cover the costs of the funerals for the deceased. But as the months turned into years, detectives retired and interested journalists moved on to new crimes and stories. The larger community of Las Cruces seems to fall into a cycle of never discussing the crime until its anniversary pops up and the family of the victim speaks out and asks for help. All of the theories and tips have led to dead ends. Over the course of 10 years, investigators looked into thousands of tips and over 1,000 suspects. They even reached out to psychics to see if any new information can come to light that way. Over the years, several TV shows like Unsolved Mysteries and America's Most Wanted have covered the murders, resulting in countless tips. But still, nothing has ever come from these tips. When Melissa Repass was 30, she told CNN that she needed the killers to be caught so she could finally stop living in fear. She said, "Then I'll be able to go out in public and feel safe. I won't constantly look over my shoulder. I won't feel for my children, for their safety, and I won't fear. I won't have fear in my own home, and that they're going to try and finish what they tried to do 21 years ago." In 2016, law enforcement confirmed the case was still open and that the evidence was routinely processed and analyzed. But they emphasized that in order to be solved, this case needed someone to step forward with significant information. In 2020, law enforcement told the public they believed the culprits were professionals based on the weapons they used, how the victims were murdered, and how they destroyed some of the evidence. They also believed the shooters were possibly from out of state, and it was suggested that the gunmen had local help to lay low for a while after the shooting. In 2002, Las Cruces, Doña Ana County Crime Stoppers announced a $25,000 reward for information leading to the suspect's arrest. Charlie Min added $7,000 to this reward, and they reissued updated composite drawings and an updated description of the men involved. But unfortunately, despite this, nothing ever came of it. After over three decades, many have expressed extreme frustration with the case. Unfortunately, the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre is still unsolved to this day. At this point, it remains up to the families and their supporters to keep alive the memories of Steve Terron, Paula Holguin, Valerie Terron, Amy Hauser, and Stephanie Senek. And I hope for the family's sake that we one day get some answers to this. I mean, it's just, it feels like law enforcement did do a fairly good job, that obviously there was some crime scene evidence that was contaminated due to the first responders, but, you know, or there could have just been a lack of training. I mean, this was something that this town, the state, had never even seen before. So I think they just were kind of ill-equipped to preserve the scene.
Yeah.
But I mean, they were dealing with what they knew. There's people that were shot. there's a fire going on. And so at that point, they're just trying to save lives. They're trying to preserve life. And so I think they did what they needed to do. And unfortunately, that may have destroyed some evidence. But I do tend to agree that whoever these two people were not just some amateur criminals. I think these guys were professional. I say that in quotes. And I do kind of feel like there's a good chance these were potentially cartel members who have had prior experience doing things like this.
Yeah, I was going to say, of all the theories that were presented, the organized crime with the debt is the one that jumps out the most to me. It seems the most reasonable. It doesn't seem like this is just some random act of violence. It seems that it was calculated. And I mean, there was a couple curiosities in the case that kind of stuck out to me, like the fact that they took money, but they didn't take all the money. If it was a robbery, they would try and take everything they have, especially if they were going to, you know, go so far as to execute everybody and try and burn down the bowling alley. It just, why wouldn't you take all of the money? It seems like, I don't want to say it seems like there was a message trying to be sent, but even that seems drastic for the cartel. But I believe that this has something to do with organized crime, especially, you know, he opened the bowling alley a week after. He wasn't very cooperative to police. It seems like he's hiding something.
Totally. No, I 100% agree with that. I think Ronald knows more than what he's ever let on to. And I think you're spot on with it. I think this is absolutely got to be connected to organized crime. And I mean, for somebody to come in and kill children and do the kind of damage that they did, I feel like there must have been something major that they were attempting to come for. You know, they were looking for something. And so maybe there was drugs or something that they were looking to get. And when they didn't find it, that upset them and they ended up doing what they did. But I feel like the fact that they also got away so quickly and then were able to fly under the radar when they were basically closing down the whole town. There's cops everywhere. It seems like in order to pull something like that off, you would need to be involved with organized crime. And I mean, we've seen this with, there's other cases sort of similar to this where you have, on the surface, it looks like maybe this was just random. Maybe this was just, you know, a really tragic event that unfolded because two people were angry or just wanted to cause harm. But I think in this particular case, there's some other motive that we still don't know for why they went so hard after the bowling alley. Because it seems like way over the top for just like a robbery. You know, most robberies that happen, nobody gets murdered.
Right.
And so when, you know, people, you know, especially multiple people get murdered in a robbery and they don't even take all of the money, it points to obviously there's something else going on here.
And if I feel like if it was meant to cause harm, there would be more evidence of that. Like, what was the case we covered with the two men who broke into the suburban house? And it started off as a robbery, but then it ended up being like sexual assault, rape,
murder. Yeah.
What was the name of that case?
The Cheshire.
The Cheshire murders. Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
That started off as just a robbery gone wrong, but then it divulged. It developed into something much more heinous and sinister.
Yeah.
This didn't do that to me. So I feel like the men who perpetrated this, they weren't doing it because they wanted to cause harm. They were doing it as directed by somebody else. And to your point, saying how they got away afterwards and they locked the city down, they had extra resource. They had extra help. This was an organized attack. It wasn't random in my eyes.
Yeah. And like even law enforcement is alluding to that they may have been from out of the state. I think they may have even been from out of the country. I mean, New Mexico is right near the border. I think there's a very good possibility that they were able to get across the border and disappear. And I don't know. I think at the end of the day, this was a organized crime operation that happened and they were, you know, somebody else was involved that they were trying to either scare or pay retribution to for something that they did. And, you know, maybe there wasn't necessarily an intention to kill children and that was just sort of something that unfolded. Other people also reported that they were not very good shots. They were just kind of like shooting all sorts, you know, bullets flying everywhere. And that sort of also leads to maybe there's more of a scare tactic, but then obviously there's the execution style murders that happen as well. And anytime I see an execution style murder, I think of organized crime.
Right.
Like that's a very, very much a organized crime type of homicide versus
it's very impersonal.
Other mass shootings that you see where it's all a little bit more random.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it's horribly sad. It's horribly tragic. Absolutely didn't need to happen. And really unfortunate that after all these years, there isn't more. There's just not enough from the scene that they're able to pull to get any definitive sort of DNA profile or fingerprints or anything that they could possibly trace back to an actual identity. And all they have to go off of is eyewitness testimony of what they saw that day and some composite sketches. But it's like a needle in a haystack, I think, at this point.
It is. And I'd really like to shout out Melissa Repass.
Yes.
Just an absolute hero of this story.
Yes.
Just an absolute warrior in her heart. And
to go through what she went through and to remain so strong and just, I can't even imagine dealing with, you know, the after effects of going through an event like this. Like, how do you even begin to deal?
Oh,
it's
insane.
Yeah, it's an incredibly terrifying thing to try to wrap your head around.
Incredibly strong person.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really curious to know what you think out there. What do you think happened? Is there another theory that maybe you didn't mention that you've seen? I'm really curious to know. Or if you're from New Mexico, what's kind of the, you know, temperature around this case down there? Is it still brought up? Do you ever hear about it? I'm really curious because it seems like this one definitely needs to be talked about more, and maybe somebody knows something and maybe they'll come forward one day. Maybe, you know, maybe there'll be a deathbed confession or something and somebody will give up some information that may at least be able to provide these families some semblance of peace and to know and maybe even justice. You know, I think that's hopeful, but it's possible. Anything is possible at this point, I think. You see cases solved 50 years later. So I don't think there's completely no hope, but I hope something more comes to light so that we can find out who is responsible for these heinous crimes. But again, let me know your thoughts on this case. I will lead this one out with a little memorial to the victims and those involved with this tragic event. I'll see you guys next time.